for members only. Golf Smarter number 194 for September 1, 2009.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The Mental Game at the Majors with Dr. Michael Lardon.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome. How's your game going? Hopefully you're getting a lot of playing time this summer, and Golf Smarter has contributed to lower scores, better rounds, and of course, more enjoyment. Now, yeah, if you're on top of our podcast feed, this show has been published a few days early because currently I'm on my way to Prague for our Golf Smarter adventure. But I didn't want to break my streak and will continue to do whatever it takes, whatever is possible, to deliver a new episode every single week. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Lardon, author of Finding Your Zone, 10 Core Lessons for Achieving Peak Performance in Sports and in Life. Michael is a sports psychologist who has been on the show before, but recently he's been getting a lot of press for his work with David Duval that led to a second place finish at the 2009 U.S. Open. We recorded this conversation just after the Open Championship, so even though we don't talk about the PGA Championship, the first three majors this year contributed so many amazing storylines that we had plenty to cover. Now, we recorded this via Skype, and unfortunately, it took me about 10 minutes to realize that Michael's headset wasn't plugged in. He was wearing it, it just wasn't plugged in. It was early in the morning, his mind is a little bit fried because, well, you'll hear the conversation. But the content was so strong, I didn't want to start over. I didn't want to try to recreate what we had in that first 10 minutes. So stay tuned because the audio quality radically improves to what you're accustomed to on this production. So let's give it a shot. Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Michael.
It's a pleasure to be here, Fred.
How have you been? I see that your congratulations are in order because a new daddy once again.
That's right. We have a five-week-old. That'll keep you up at night.
Oh, man. And a couple more you have to chase around. Very different when you get a second and third kid than just having one, isn't it?
Well, it's a little like football. You go from man-to-man defense. Now my wife and I, we just have zone defense.
That's a safe way to look at it. You're running a zone defense against your kids. We always had the rule in my house that children were not allowed to outnumber the adults. So we stopped at two kids because we were like, well, what if all three of them get sick? Who's going to carry the last kid into the doctor's office?
Exactly.
Congratulations to you. You've done a lot of work with David Duval. And I think that what was so interesting about the majors that we had this year, the U.S. Open and the British Open specifically, is that the mental game became, I guess it was a testimonial to the mental game with these two players, Tom Watson and David Duval, who both came in second place. But it was more of a testimonial to mental game than it was to just ball striking ability for both of these guys.
Well, yeah, you see them both really coming from obscurity at some level. I mean, obviously, Watson and Duval are great champions, but over the last, you know, the recent years, they haven't really performed that well, and they were both able to get everything in sync. And it really speaks to one of the themes that I think sports psychiatrists and sports psychologists deliver to the athlete, which is, if you have that ability, that gift, it's a dispositional quality, and it's something that lives in you. You don't lose it. You might misplace it, but it's there. And so it was very nice to see them both go in deep and harvest up that energy and that focus to compete at that very high level.
Boy, there was a pun there somewhere when you talk about Watson and being in sync. I'm sure he wouldn't have wanted to hear the word sync.
Yeah, but you know what? Stuart Sink's an awfully nice guy, Fred. And
that's great.
I've talked to him a couple of times over the years, and he actually sees a psychodynamic psychiatrist, but more for psychotherapy. But he talks about how his work with that psychiatrist really parlays into helping him in golf.
Interesting.
And yeah, very interesting.
Well, all during the Open, the Open Championship, when Watson finishes in the first day in the lead, all the pundits, all the analysts are all talking about, yeah, well, can he be in the lead tomorrow? And can he be in the lead on Saturday? And can he be on the lead on Sunday? And he really took it to the absolute limit, you know, losing it, unfortunately, on the last putt of the round. But he hung tight the whole time, and he stayed there, and he looked great, and he looked confident.
Well, I mean, even I think about his tee shot in 18, just striped right down the middle. And, you know, his vulnerability over the most recent years has been that short to mid-range putt, and that ended up being his nemesis in the end. Mm. But his composure, I mean, it's not an accident that Tom Watson won 5 British Opens and is, you know, a legendary golfer. And we really got to see an ability to go back in time and really remember what a great player he was.
And then, of course, the analysts and everyone wants to talk about, well, after he missed that final putt, he just collapsed. I mean, those, you know, that four-hole playoff, and especially the one hole where he lost by 3 strokes. Do you see that as being exhaustion taking over, a mental thing? Do you have any way of analyzing that?
I mean, my thought is, and maybe it's my own projection, but when he putted on 18, he had to make up and down to win the tournament. And, you know, he's a great chipper, but the putting has been suspect. And he hit that putt, I guess, about 8 feet by. And there was some sense that, when he made that putt coming back, it really wasn't his best effort. And you got the sense that his mental energy just was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And when he missed that, I think that his mindset was, you know, the door of opportunity had closed, and he just didn't have any more energy left. But still, again, what a performance.
What a performance. And really, you've got to – it's amazing that someone can, at the age of 59, take it as far as he did and give it absolutely everything he's got. You would think that exhaustion or collapse, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just not psyched up for another 4 holes. I mean, I've given myself this barrier of the 72 holes, and I just, 4 more, I just can't go.
Well, it's just an amazing thing. I mean, to think about it, he's going to be 60 years old this year. And in what sport, baseball, tennis, football, any sport, can we even imagine an athlete competing at the highest level in the world at that age? And you just can't think of it.
No, it doesn't exist.
I mean, Jack Nicklaus, when he won the Masters at 46 years old, that was a pretty impressive feat. If Tom Watson did go on and to win this one, it would be absolutely remarkable. And it was still remarkable. And I think it really speaks to our time, we're in the time in which we live, where people can do more and more as when they get older. I remember when I was growing up, my dad had his 40th birthday party, and I was thinking, my gosh, he's so old. And, you know, and here I am, 50 this next year. And, you know, maybe we're not that old, right? So I think that was a great message Tom gave to all the sports fans.
Oh, I think he got a lot of people out of their Sunday chairs and brought them back out to the golf course.
Yeah, they take a lot more ibuprofen. He'll be a great candidate for a Advil commercial now.
or as Mondale did, a Viagra commercial.
Yeah, there you go.
So let's talk about the other great second-place finish. I can't imagine. One of the things that cracks me up about golf, especially the majors, is the betting pools that begin and the emails that you receive saying, hey, you want to be in this pool? Hey, who's your pick? I can't imagine that anybody on the U.S. Open would have picked David Duval to finish in the top 3 or, you know, to finish second. He's been out of contention. He's been out of our conversation for such a long time now.
I'm sure you're right. However, I think that those of us that know him well and work with him closely, not that surprised. I received a a phone call from David on, I guess it was Tuesday night. He left a message, and it was really a really nice message, and basically saying that, you know, he thought his mind was in good stead, and that I need not worry, and that all he needed is a putt or two to go in at the right time, and that he could win this thing. And that might sound like pie in the sky dreaming, but over the last 5 weeks, he started to hit the ball better and better. I had talked to Puggy Blackman, his coach, a few times, and you know, there's that critical mass, there's that tipping point, and the players have been seeing it on tour, even though David's results until this U.S. Open have been, you know, quite modest. You know, just at the range, his ball striking is getting better. Early in the year, his putting really, really was good. And the question was, you know, which week really would these things line up? And when they lined up at Bethpage, you can see this, the level that he can command. So it's not as out of the blue as you might imagine. I think from the public's viewpoint, they're not privy to all those little subtleties, but we've been seeing this momentum growing and growing.
How long have you worked with David?
Let's see. David first came out to San Diego to see me before Shinnecock. So it was, I think, late 2002, probably late 2002 or early 2003. And David Ledbetter had orchestrated our meeting, and that's when we first started hanging out.
And when you started working with him, had he was he ranked number one in the world at that point, or had he started falling down from that position?
No. He had already had his fall from grace, if you will.
Yeah, it's a delicate way to put it. I mean, how do you put it? I mean, the guy was ranked number one in the world as in golf, and then things just started to... What happened?
Implode.
Yeah, implode. What happens there? How do you... I mean, it's not about striking at that point. It's got to be something bigger.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just shows you the fragile nature of peak performance and how it can come and go. And I think in David's case, there were a number of circumstances that lined up, and you know, he lost his drive, his motivation, his feel, his confidence, and you know, then he spiraled down. And so when I started first working with him, he was really having you know, questions as to, you know, did he want to really come back and make his way back? And did he really need to? So we really started from the beginning once again. And I think for me, helping him through the years, I'm very proud of his, most proud of his perseverance, because I can't tell you, Fred, how tough it's been for him to endure the media scrutiny, the questions time after time. And then almost sarcasm from some of the journalists and the announcers as to, are you kidding me? You know, you've lost it. But it was nice to see him really answer a lot of those questions with his sticks. So,
how is it possible to avoid that conversation? I mean, with the way we're bombarded with media from all ends, and even if you're a person who's got the ability to have tremendous amount of focus, you get away from the golf course, you get away from the driving range, and, you know, you follow sports, you follow news. You're going to bound to see your name. How is it that he can let that fall behind him, or does he? Does it really get to him?
It's a good question. I mean, my advice to uniformly to really all the elite athletes that I work with is, you know, don't read the newspaper, stay away from the media, because either they'll build you up too much, and that sort of sets you up for expectations, which are, you know, the nemesis of peak performance, or they'll say things that you don't like that are hurtful, and the media is really designed to, you know, sell newspapers and propagate itself. So It's very tricky because, if you turn on Golf Channel, you hear this, you hear that. But I suggest for the athletes just to TiVo everything. And at the end of the year, they can have a weekend party, and then they can see all the good and the bad.
Yeah, right. All of a sudden, there's a lot less noise because we kind of figured out that the headset you were using on Skype wasn't plugged in properly. We have it working now, so I apologize to everybody for all the noise that we had before. That was really my fault. I should have caught that earlier. But this actually brings up an interesting thing about the work that you do with the athletes and the use of Skype. You use Skype when you talk to your clients, right?
Yeah, I mean, I find it not as powerful as being with the client, but much, much more powerful than being on the telephone. So, there are the subtleties that we see when we're in the presence of each other: fear in the eyes, anxiety, comfort, confidence, and it's an amazing tool because it's difficult, especially as we talked earlier, me now with three kids under the age of five, to travel. A Saturday night, I was going to fly to Bethpage, and one of our children, they got sick and just couldn't make it. So it's really nice to be able to just, beam your image in and talk with your athlete, whether he's 3,000 miles away or, on the other side of the world. So it's a tremendous, tremendous technology.
Well, it allows them to maintain their travel schedule. It allows you to stay at home, but it adds a level of intimacy because here we are, the audience isn't aware of it, but we're looking at each other. We're using the video aspect of this. It allows a level of intimacy that you can't get on the telephone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an amazing thing. I mean, I think when I first entered medicine, I guess graduated medical school in 89, we talked about this type of medicine, but it was really a pie in the sky. Mm. And right now, the military here in San Diego, I know that the Navy uses this technology all the time, and we can use it to help athletes. And so this is the new world, Fred.
Yeah, it really is. When you work with a high, high-level athlete like David Duval, it's not like they're going in to work out issues they had as a child. How do you start with them? Where do you begin? And what is it that you're trying to find to bring them to that confidence level?
That's a great question. And I think, as a psychiatrist, I always like to think that the answer to the problem is really in asking the correct questions, the salient questions. So it does make me think of one thing. When I first met David and he came out to my house in 03 or late 02, the first question I really had was, why are you doing this? Do you don't need to do it?
When you say, what's it? You mean the use it?
Golf.
Oh, why are you doing golf?
Yeah, because,
therapy.
No. Yeah, no. it's very interesting in that, you reach that level of success, you have financial freedom, and you have the ability, you'll have one life, and, maybe there's more to life than just hitting a golf ball. And so the question is, and that really gets to the deeper question as to what is your motivation. And if I remember correctly, I mean, I think David kind of looked at me with a smile, which was sort of implied. No one's ever asked me that, because typically, famous wealthy athletes are surrounded by people that make money from them, and they have their own vested interest, and they always don't get a broader question, or as to, they can do anything they want. And I think that gave David some relief. I'm more interested in the human being first. And then if that's whole and the person's doing well, that translates into performance in whatever domain in their life. But the most important piece is to respect and honor the sanctity of their life. And I think that's one of the problems in high-level professional sports is that the athlete grows up playing for fun, enjoys the game, falls in love, is highly motivated. And then at some point in time, you know, the money, the media, the endorsements, the public persona, it wears on them and they lose the fun, they lose the motivation, and they sort of forget why they're really there in the beginning. And that's probably one of the themes that I think we try to reconnect the athlete to, you know, how to have fun, childlike with their sport. Because if you don't have that piece, you certainly can't perform at the highest level.
Well, you mentioned it earlier, is that once you start buying into and maybe even believing all the that you read, that all of a sudden it becomes the expectation of your performance. You have those expectations there, and that's the kiss of death.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember at one point, maybe a couple of years ago, David and I were in the desert for the Bob Hope out there, and I think I asked him, I said, because he was getting bombarded by the media a little bit and, you know, not the most pleasant questions.
Sure.
And I said, do you think your comeback would be easier if you weren't David Duval? And he looked at me and said, absolutely.
Wow. Wow. I don't know if you've seen the book Breaking the Slump by Jimmy Roberts from NBC Sports and ESPN.
Oh, I'd love to see it.
Oh, yeah. We did a show on it. You should go back into our archives. He talks about David.
Does he?
Yeah. He has a chapter on David. He's got 18 chapters on there, and it goes from Palmer and Nicholas and Greg Norman and David's in there, but he also has George Herbert Walker Bush, and he's got some other athletes that were not golfers, but they played golf in their life, but they all knew success at the highest level.
And Jimmy Roberts he's a friend of my friend Eric Heiden, the speed skater.
Sure, I've met Eric.
Yeah, and Eric, Eric and Jimmy, they first met when Eric tells me this story. I guess it was a U.S. Open. Eric was telling me about how Jimmy basically was the guy, you know, running down to the mail room and, you know, the courier, if you will, and worked his way all the way up to the level of announcer he is today. And they developed a friendship. And Eric encouraged me to go by and say hi to Jimmy. I guess it was a couple years ago at a U.S. Open. And that's when I first met him. But a very nice guy. So I'd love to read that book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I'm going to bring this full circle between you having a new baby and Eric Heiden brings me back to a story of my own. When my first son was born, Eric Heiden had just won his gold medal in speed skating, right, in the Olympics.
It was five of them. He won five.
That's right. And this was 1980?
80.
Right.
1980, late
1980.
Classic.
So my son was born in late 82. And at the time, somebody gave him, instead of having his shoes bronzed, you know, the baby shoes bronzed as he got older, I decided since his very first pair of shoes were a pair of Nikes, that why should I have these bronzed? So I had famous athletes autograph them, and I got Eric Heiden's autograph on a little teeny pair of Nikes.
You know what? I'll have to mention that to him next time I talk to him.
He was in San Francisco.
And I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure he'll remember signing some baby shoes.
No, I doubt it. I doubt it very much. John
That's
Madden's
very funny.
Was there. Yeah. So I have all these people. I have a couple of Olympic gold medalists on there, too. Tracy Ruiz is on there. Anyway, so back to golf. I'm sorry for that aside. It's the fascination for me on David and his success, and now we hope that it continues.
Well,
didn't see his
yeah.
name very much at Turnberry. Did he play Turnberry? I don't even know if he was at Turnberry. What happened there?
Yeah, no, he was there. He shot one over the first day. And I think four over the next day, just missed the cut by one or two.
He wasn't the only one.
Yeah. And I've been asked that question a number of times, as you might imagine, over the last month. Is this, you know, just a flash in the pan? But if you really think about it, that doesn't really make a lot of logical sense. If David was satisfied with his performance, and just wanted to kind of come back for that one tournament, that would be one thing. But I've talked to him since, and you know, this is certainly a place he wants to build from. Obviously, he's going to gain tremendous confidence from it, and has. You know, in golf, the best players in the world don't always play good every week, i.e. Sure. we saw this human side of Tiger Woods this last tournament. But I can't imagine that we're not going to be seeing more of David in a big way over this next year or two.
That would be phenomenal. I really love that you put that, that it's the human side of Tiger Woods or these athletes. And maybe that's something that recreational golfers like myself forget about. That it's like we can't perform at that level all the time. And the expectations that we put on ourselves, even to break 100 or break 95 or break 90 or even lower, we probably are our own worst enemies out there as well.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's why if you're a 90 shooter, you know, you'll go out there and if you shoot, you know, 40, you're bound to shoot 50 on the backside or vice versa. I mean, we put these expectations, these bars, and they're often unconscious. We see ourselves at a certain level. I think many, many years ago, you know, as you know, Fred, my younger brother played on the PGA Tour. He had 5 full years out there. And in the beginning of his career, I did send him to Bob Rotella. And after a 3-day visit to Bob Rotella's house, I asked Brad, so, what did he say? You know, what did you learn? And basically,
now, were you asking as a brother or were you asking as the psychologist?
Well, you know, a little of both, a little of both. So, I mean, 2 answers. So one was, hey, bro, you know, he says the same thing you always say. you know, that was $3,000 later. And then, you know, then in those days, that was more than $3,000 carries today. And then part two, no, the one very valuable thing was, I think Bob Rotella helped my brother see that at some unconscious level, my brother just saw himself good enough to get a tour card, but it was very hard for him to really imagine or visualize himself, you know, playing at the elite level. Now, whether or not there were other factors that ultimately determined his level of play, certainly that psychological set of where do you see yourself is a very, very big factor. And it happens to amateurs and not amateurs and professionals alike. So I think that phenomenon is very real.
Very real. The idea of how you see yourself and your own expectations, beyond expectations, but just how you see yourself. I got down to a 10-8 at one point in my handicap and never believed it. And it's like, uh-huh. I'm a 10-8 now, but I'm really about a 13-5, maybe a 14 on a good day. You know, it's like I never, and so...
Right. Don't stay there then, right?
Yeah, right. And of course, I'm now back up to a 13-something or other, and it's interesting because just got back from a couple days up in the Lake Tahoe area. We were playing with some listeners. We won some prizes and we got to play at Edgewood Tahoe just after they had their celebrity championship up there. And that's a difficult course. I mean, it's a beautiful course. Scenery spectacular.
I caddied for Eric Heiden.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
So have you played the course or did you just... You just walked it.
I just caddied for him.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, you know that, you know, there's a lot of difficult shots there and uneasy lies. I played there at the end of last year when I was first meeting with them, and I shot in the mid-90s. So I had 2 rounds there. And so my goal coming back was, I got to break 90. First day out, we play in the afternoon, and I shot a 98. I didn't even have a par on the back 9, and I was just... It was tired. I was exhausted, and I feel like the course was beating me up. We had a round the next morning, and everything went well, and I shot an 80.
Wow.
Exactly my word.
2 different people, Fred 1 and Fred 2.
Yeah. How do we keep Fred 2 happy and around a lot more than, you know, it was just interesting how I just – I don't know if I was more relaxed, I was more comfortable. I just felt like this putt is going in. You know, I was standing over, I see the line. That's not going to be a problem. It's going to go
in. Well, remember last year, Vijay Singh, he was talking He won an event, I can't remember which one, and in some interviews he was giving, he was saying that he started to just say to himself, I'm the best putter in the world. I can make everything. Sort of like a mantra. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there you go. A few weeks later, next thing you know, he has a great putting week and he wins. And I think that's a good segue back to David. I think that David never, ever lost the belief that he really was, you know, or really is among the best players in the world, despite, you know, everyone telling him, you know, come on, wake up, you know, you just don't have it anymore. He didn't believe it. And there were even some very prominent coaches, which I will not name, but very high profile, that said some really, I think, painful things to him that he wouldn't get and wouldn't make it back again. And I think that was something he maybe even used to fuel some motivation to keep focused on his goal. So that's a great thing. A great point is, you know, how do we ultimately see ourselves? And that really is a very large determinant as to the level which we can compete.
Right. But what's the downside of that voice being on your right shoulder, whispering in your ear all the time, I'm the best putter in the world, I'm the best putter in the world? At some point, there's got to be the voice in the other shoulder whispering, going, but yeah, but you know who you really are. I mean, how do you protect yourself from that?
Well, I mean, you know, that that's human nature. You know, that's right. The good and the bad, the demons within us. How do we deal with that? And, you know, in Eastern thought, manifestation, prana, energy, internal energy comes from thought. And before we create anything in the world around us, we first have to think it and imagine it and dream it and visualize it. And you can give way to doubt and fear. And when you do, you don't do as well in life with anything. I mean, you take surviving cancer. There's many studies to show that David Spiegel at Stanford has done tremendous work in women with breast cancer, shows that positive attitudes in group therapies have tremendous impact on survival rates. So, you know, I mean, of course, there is a reality to what's going on, but at the same time, state of mind is a tremendous, tremendously important variable. So whether it's in sport or other parts of life.
Well, actually, a testimony to another story that happened up at Tahoe this week on that same vein is one of the winners up there brought his wife with him, and she plays golf as well. And I was playing with them on that second round when I played really well. He broke his personal best in the front nine. He shot a 39. He'd never shot a score that low on nine holes. But his wife was, you know, she's playing from the red tees. She's hitting it straight, but she's not hitting it far. And then, you know, she when I would ask her the score at the end of each hole, because I was keeping score, she's like, oh, I got a double. And, oh, I, you know, and like, oh, I had a triple. And so at one point I said to her, I think around the eighth hole, I said, you know, I think that you really need to forget about what par is, because I think that's hurting you. I think that maybe you should create your own par. Maybe if you said, I'm a double bogey, you know, double bogey is par for me.
Right.
If I play double bogey golf, I had a good hole.
Well, I mean, that is a great point. And you know, to take that a little bit further, one of the drills that I do with the golfers and different variations with whatever kind of athlete I'm working with is this two scorecard to move them away from that. And the two scorecard drill is, on a hole, you might make a par, a bogey, a birdie, or what have you, and that's how people generally interpret their performance. But I challenge them to do this. You know, everything that happens after impact, we cannot control.
Right.
So after you've hit that ball, you know, it's out of your control. But we can control the events prior to impact. And so in golf, it's very simple. Can you visualize that shot you want? You know, you make your calculation, you visualize the shot. And then we have two boxes, the box behind where you make that mental calculation, how you see that shot. And then when you step in to hit the shot, you hit it with no extraneous thoughts and with full commitment. If you have an extraneous thought, you're disciplined enough to back out of the shot. You see Tiger Woods do this every week. And then you go back in and execute the shot. If you've done that, that is a one for one. If you didn't do it, it's an 0-for-1. Now, and it's not a function of whether it goes in the cup, goes in the rough, down the middle of the fairway. So you could potentially make a par on a hole, and let's say it's a par 4, you could be 0-for-4. You could potentially make a bogey, hit a beautiful drive, and do everything right, but it goes through, bad lie, and you could be 5-for-5. So this way, it moves people from the results back into the process. So with tour players, typically when I start working with them, they're about 80%. Amateurs, you know, less, maybe 50-40%. But when people are playing their best, they're at, you know, 95%+, meaning the percentage of their shots that they were impeccable on seeing that shot, committing to that shot, and executing it with all their ability. And that's how we try to get people to focus. Forget the bogey, forget the par, forget those things. Just be in that moment. So there's a lot to that.
Yeah. Well, as a postscript to all that, she understood my concept, and I was explaining, saying, you know, just if you played double bogey golf, then you had a great day. She shot a 44 on the back. She beat her husband on the back nine by one stroke. And she, like, you know, got a par. She got a 5 on a par 5. I mean, she had a great stretch when she just relaxed and let it go.
Let those expectations leave.
That's exactly what it was. It was phenomenal, and she was a lot of fun to play with, and she was even more fun on the back nine, you can imagine. It was great. Well, congratulations on your success with David, and congratulations to David on his own success. Now, I hope that he shares some of the credit, that he gives you some of the credit here, but of course, and you will pass that along, saying, no, it was all inside him all the way, I guess. Is that safe
to
assume?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the one hitting the ball.
Right.
He did. I mean, he left me a very nice phone call after the tournament and thanked me and said Susie and he thanked me. Susie's his wife. And it was very heartfelt. And for me, that gives me a great feeling of satisfaction. And, I genuinely like him very much. He's a very honest, straight ahead, stand up kind of guy. It's really nice to see him do well. And I think when you, as a doctor, when you work with someone for a long time, you know, there's this human connection that you make with them.
Sure.
And so I've seen all his struggles and, just hats off to him. And whether or not all that comes out in all the media, I mean, this is some media right here, this interview. I think what's important is really David's perseverance and sets a great example for people that you can come back after adversity and still regain a tremendous form. So I think it's just a great thing.
Yeah, as we started, the testimony to both what he has accomplished and what Tom Watson accomplished speaks volumes to what anybody can accomplish.
Well, yeah. I mean, so many of us have these giants we dream within us, and we just really don't believe in it because the world beats us down. It would be... You know, I mean, I don't know all about Ian Baker Finch's life, but, you know, he won the British Open, was a top player, and sort of lost it and never made it back. Now, it became a very good announcer, and he's a very nice man. I've met him a couple times, but that's probably the easier thing to do. It takes tremendous courage and endurance to stay with it and stay with it and stay with it and find yourself finally back up on top. So to see Tom Watson do it at almost 60 years old, that is that's a feat that even eclipses David. But both these last two majors have been fantastic.
They really have. And I read a short piece that you forwarded to me that was in Golf Digest talking about your relationship with David and after his success there at the U.S. Open. And one of the things that jumped out to me is the text message that you sent David complimenting him on his focus. I don't know if that's the writer's interpretation or what it is that you said to him, but I just like that you compliment on his focus.
Well, I mean, you know, he's been able to, you know, get himself into a place, into his own private bubble, where he, you know, he could build his confidence and feel good about what he's doing. And that really is not an easy thing to do. So, in some way, it's a little like studying for a test. You know, we get all angst up if we have a big exam in school. But really, by the time that exam comes, you've done your homework. You've done the work. Mm-hmm. And you can think of the exam as the opportunity to finally, you know, relax and show what you got going on there. And I think the message that the writer was referring to, I was telling him about a comment I had made to David about, you know, you've done all this work, you've done the hard part, now you're finally, you know, in the position to let the thing unfold, and really speaking to the mental side of his game. So, yeah, I was proud of him, very proud of him.
That's fabulous. Well, your book, let's talk about it once again, because it is available on our Golfers Mart here at golfsmarter.com. It's called Finding Your Zone, 10 Core Lessons for Achieving Peak Performance in Sports and Life by Dr. Michael Lardon, MD. And we appreciate you coming back onto the Golf Smarter podcast and sharing your story with us. And I know it's a, you know, it's not something everybody wants to talk about, their client relationship, but I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your relationship with David.
Well, pleasure to be here, Fred. And I enjoy your show very much and wish you the very best.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Now, there's a couple reminders before we close out today. There are still a few Tour Tempo Micro Players available. And as a member, you get 30% off when you enter the coupon code TTMP001. You'll find that at golfsmarter.com inside our Golfers Mart. And our event just after President's Cup, the next event, is in the Bay Area, and it's really shaping up to be a great outing. I'm very proud of this one. I hope you can join us at Peacock Gap in Marin County, just north of San Francisco, where they are playing the President's Cup, and we're doing it the day after. We'll play golf, have a barbecue, do a recording session of episode number 200, give away prizes, including playing golf with the head teaching professional at Peacock Gap, Adam Eisner, and Jesse Ortiz.
Hi, this is Jesse Ortiz with the Bobby Jones Golf Company, inviting you to sign up at golfsmarter.com for a chance to play with me at Peacock Gap on Monday, October 12th, which is Columbus Day, the day after the President's Cup at Harding Park in San Francisco. We're going to have a demo tent out there. You can try out the entire family of Bobby Jones golf products. Three lucky winners will have a chance to play with me. There'll be a barbecue and a recording session of Golf Smarter podcast after the round of golf. There'll also be audience Q&A, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have about the industry, club design, or just golf in general. Space is limited, so make sure you sign up early at golfsmarter.com.
It's barbecue, pars, and podcasts on Monday, October 12th, Columbus Day. It is a holiday. You have no excuse. In Marin County, California, space is limited, so please sign up now. Hey, congratulations, Stephen Spurlock of Washington, D.C. You have just won the latest in iron protection technology, a 10-piece cover set of snug neoprene iron head covers courtesy of Iron Armor, the creation of a Golf Smarter member. Check them out at ironarmor.com, ironarmour.com. We close with a quote that came from LinkedIn, a business social network and that I participate in, and you probably do too. And in their golfers group, I've been participating in a conversation with a group of people responding to someone's request about deciding between a new set of Callaway X22s or TaylorMade Burner 09s. And this guy's a 16 to 18 handicap, and he just wanted to know which one to buy. Well, of course, at the time of this writing, there were 17 different comments, and my response was, get fitted before you decide on what brand to buy. But I love what Bill Atwood provided. His insight was very clear and I thought worthy of this week's quote. The biggest benefit to me of having my clubs fitted is mental. If I hit a bad shot, I know it's me, not the clubs. I can accept that and move on. Next week, the long-awaited return of Michael Murphy, author of Golf in the Kingdom. If you have any questions, comments, requests, or quotes, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.